And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today, the 22nd of April, is Earth Day. And in honor of Earth Day, we are replaying two interesting interviews from the morning show archives related to the natural world. Here is part one. We're going to be talking on this portion of WGTD's morning show about one of the most important, perhaps the most important issues and concerns of the day, climate change, and the catastrophic possibility of a future under that very dark cloud. But we're looking at climate change today through very different eyes and through the lens of a new book called Climate Restoration, which calls on the human race to not just stop what is causing climate change, but to actually seek to restore the climate of our planet. That is, to restore it to conditions that it was were once seen on this planet, and when life was much easier and better for human beings and for all creatures, for that matter. Such a possibility might seem audacious indeed, but not according to the co-authors of this new book called Climate Restoration, The Only Future That Will Sustain the Human Race. It is the contention of the co-authors of this book, Peter Fikowski and my morning show guest, Carol Douglas, that there are technologies that exist today that might very well make possible the removal of excess CO2 from the atmosphere. And through a concerted effort to utilize these technologies, it might actually be possible not only to stop the causes of climate change, but in a sense to reverse the ravages that excess carbon dioxide has caused. And it is a fascinating proposition and important. And I'm really glad that we can have a few minutes to speak with Carol Douglas, an award-winning journalist who has written extensively about climate change and sustainability issues for several decades. Her work has appeared in The Atlantic, Psychology Today, Harper's, and in an array of books from the National Geographic Society. This current book is published by Rivertowns Books, again titled Climate Restoration, The Only Future That Will Sustain the Human Race. Carol Douglas, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, and thank you for that wonderful introduction. You really sound like you've absorbed the messages. I appreciate that.
No problem. Tell us how you first connected with your co-author, Peter Fikowski, and the circumstances under which you co-wrote this book.
Well, Peter Fikowski is a physicist, entrepreneur, Silicon Valley engineer, and has spent about 10 years researching and discovering how we might reclaim the climate that will allow us to survive and thrive in the future. I hooked up with him through people I know in the environmental field, and since I had written about climate before, we became writing partners. He's the prime mover. He is the moving force behind this new movement called climate restoration. And climate restoration means, as you brought up, restoring the climate that humans have survived long term. It's bringing the climate back to the way it was in pre-industrial times, so that farmers know when to plant, we don't have these monster storms and floods, these disabling droughts and crazy wildfires, and we get back to a world that we know how to live on and flourish in. That's the goal of climate restoration. And as you say, we already know how to do it. We have the know-how. We have the technology, which is all based on natural processes. We even have financing. We don't need government funding, although it would help kick it off. All that's missing is the will. All that's missing is for everyone to stand up, let their voice be heard, that we insist on climate restoration as the goal of climate action. That's not our current goal.
One of the chief points of the book is that the standards laid out in the Paris Climate Accords are not enough. And of course, even there, the Climate Accords of Paris have not been adopted by every single country on Earth. And the United States, for a time, of course, under President Donald Trump, stepped decisively away from the Paris Climate Accords and its goals. But even if we were all on board, if every nation on board, on the Earth was on board with the Paris Climate Accords, that would not be enough. That would be far from enough in terms of making the planet what we want it and need it to be. Explain why that is not sufficient.
You're absolutely right. I think most people think that we're aiming at a livable climate, but actually, the world's current climate goal is to reduce carbon emissions until we reach net zero emissions by 2050. In other words, not putting any more in. That's the focus of the United Nations, the Paris goal, as you say, and that's what most climate activists are working on. And it's really important for lots of reasons. It's also, as you say, wholly insufficient, because if we stop burning fossil fuels, even if we stop, we will still be left with this gigantic pool of CO2 lingering in the atmosphere, which we've pumped up there in the last two centuries. And when I say gigantic, I mean it. There's an extra trillion tons of CO2 in the atmosphere. If we don't put any more in, that's good. But what's better, what's a more sensible climate goal, is to take that out, because it's the CO2 that's up there already and we're still adding to that is causing the climate havoc.
So one of the things that your book spells out are four different technologies that currently exist, I mean, to varying degrees, that are essentially technologies designed for the removal of excess CO2 from the atmosphere. And of course, we would leave it to people to explore these in depth by looking at your book. But summarize for us these four different technologies that currently exist that could be brought to bear on this issue of excess CO2 in the atmosphere.
Thank you. Yes. We say that we can remove this excess CO2 by 2050 because Mother Nature removes CO2 all the time from the atmosphere. And now we know precisely how she does it, and we have figured out how to copy and accelerate the processes in an approach called biomimicry. We do what happens naturally, but on an accelerated scale. So here's an example. Nature constantly packs away CO2 in the form of limestone. Limestone is magical. Limestone is nearly half, by weight, CO2. It's calcium carbonate, calcium plus CO2. So think about the White Cliffs of Dover. Most of the carbon in the world is in cliffs and shelves like that. It comes from oysters, clams, corals, and all kinds of other little tiny marine animals. They make their shells out of calcium carbonate. Then when they die, those shells drop to the seafloor, and eventually they get compressed into limestone. So again, limestone is nearly half CO2 by weight, and that's a permanent storage system. It's not coming out of limestone. So recently, scientists have figured out how to make synthetic limestone from CO2 they pull out of the air, and calcium they're now getting from recycled concrete. This synthetic limestone, it's pure, it's manufactured, it's tested and standardized. It's being used, used for building and for making the aggregate that goes into concrete, terrific quality concrete. It doesn't have to be developed. It's happening right now. For example, the San Francisco airport has already built a terminal using this carbon-negative concrete. The company, Blue Planet Systems, has recently built a plant in the Bay Area, and it's so the San Francisco Airport Authority has purchased its entire output for the next 2 years to build terminals and runways. So there's a huge demand for this climate restoring project. A lot of people talk about pulling carbon dioxide out of the air and sticking it underground or something, but that's humongously expensive and slow. Instead, we pull it out in a natural way, more natural way, and store it away in products that there's a tremendous demand for. That's one. The others include, very briefly, restoring the fertility of the oceans. We all know that the oceans are dying, and it's not just because of overfishing and coral bleaching. A healthy ocean is green because it has a lot of photosynthesis going on. And photosynthesis, of course, is done by green plants, both tiny phytoplankton and large seaweed. And in healthy parts of the ocean, the photosynthesis is so intense that, for one thing, it restores fisheries, it restores the chain of life in the oceans. And, again, that intense photosynthesis pulls in a lot of CO2, and whatever isn't eaten goes down. When it dies, it sinks towards the depths of the ocean where it doesn't rot. Unlike trees, they photosynthesize too, and they're great, but eventually they rot or they burn. Seaweed doesn't. So, other sea plants, they don't. So that's another way, another nature biomimicked way of drawing down a lot of CO2. And the others, there's a couple of more. Mm-hmm. Well, one is farming larger seaweed, and that they photosynthesize like crazy. Kelp can grow 2 feet a day. So you can use some of it, and then some of it will sink and take the CO2 down to the depths of the ocean. I find this absolutely fascinating. People have recently figured out how to use kelp and other seaweed, sargassum, as a substitute for petroleum. I kid you not. You can make biofuel out of it. You can make all kinds of foods and food products out of the kelp version. You can make fertilizers, the basis for medicines, and even plastics and a vegan leather out of seaweed. So that's starting to take off, and that's very exciting.
What's interesting to me, among other things, is that in at least one of these cases, it sounds like we're talking about a technology that was not developed from the start with this climate issue in mind, or at least not primarily. I mean, that these, at least some of these technologies are perhaps with us for other reasons and can, in a sense, be redirected to this pressing, even paramount issue of climate change. Is that fair to say?
In some cases, absolutely, yes. People have been farming seaweed forever. It's very, very big in parts of Asia. In fact, there's components of seaweed in a lot of our products, particularly ice cream. Some of this is newer. So that's a traditional industry. Some of these newer efforts are being designed specifically with the carbon dioxide removal aspect in mind, in such a way that they make products that people will buy. And that's really important, because if you take CO2 out of the air and you stick it in the ground, that doesn't do anything for anyone, right? You're not making anything useful. You just have to keep paying for that to happen, and it's quite expensive. If you take CO2 out of the air or the ocean, and you make something useful with it, you sell it in a very large scale, not little things, but on a large scale, you make synthetic limestone or these kelp farms, you're actually creating a market so that it can pay for itself. You enrich the fertility of the oceans in certain small areas. The fisheries come back, and climate restoration then is paid for by the fishing market. So that's, I find, just absolutely intriguing, and I think that's a large part of what will make this successful, is that it only takes investment for which there will be some return. It doesn't take, you know, trillions of government dollars.
One thing that is compelling about at least some of these possibilities is that it is a matter of turning to nature and to some of the climate restoration that Mother Nature herself or itself has already achieved earlier in our planet's history. That in fact, this is not something in a sense utterly new. And there's something sort of oddly reassuring about the thought that some of these efforts would in a sense piggyback on, or in some ways even sort of mimic, what the planet Earth itself has done before earlier in its history.
Exactly right. In fact, this trillion tons of CO2 happens to be the same amount that nature has withdrawn from the atmosphere 10 times over the last million years. CO2 mounts up, gets very, very high, these things kick in, photosynthesis goes crazy in the ocean, and little shelled creatures are busy building their shells and making limestone, and the temperature and CO2 levels drop. You can see this on a map of the last million years, a graph of the CO2 ups and downs. So, of course, when nature does it, it happens over thousands of years, and we need it to happen over decades. But we know how to do it. Yes, it's not like putting enormous mirrors in the sky or stuff like that, which may have its own merits. But this is it's biomimicked, and sometimes we call it geomimicry as well, creating synthetic limestone.
What would you gauge the level of preparedness in terms of these technologies? I suspect that in order to do this and to accomplish it, the technologies need further development, further refinement, and so on. I'm not even sure how one gauges that or scales that sort of thing. But, I mean, where are these technologies at this moment?
Great question. They are developed. They are researched. They're developed. And what we think is that they need to be scaled up and can be scaled up enough to withdraw the quantities needed over this decade, and then work at full tilt for the next 20 years so that we are done by 2050. They've all been tested, they've all been demonstrated, they work. Well, one of them is a little, yeah. The three that I mentioned, they work. And, of course, like any large project, they're being refined all the time. And, of course, like with any large project, they will be constantly monitored so that if anything should go awry, it can be course-corrected. It's a project. Yeah, there. The synthetic limestone, as I mentioned, San Francisco Airport is all over it, and they have new plants going up in Europe and other places. The seaweed, it's called one of the projects is called a marine permaculture array, meaning that you have these frames that you set out in precise areas in the open ocean, so you're not near the shore, and kelp can attach to these frames, and it becomes a whole little mini ecosystem. The fish come for habitat, and then the little, you know, the big fish eat the little fish and all that stuff. That is, it has been developed. It's still in process of scaling. So it's in some process of demonstration.
A last question. How would you characterize the receptiveness of the overall scientific community to some of these possibilities?
Yes, it varies a lot. Our premise is that everyone wants to restore a safe climate, a climate that we know is safe because humans have survived in it long term. That's our premise. And that for it to happen, we need to make climate restoration our goal. It's not going to happen just if we keep saying all we need to do is stop emissions. We need to make it our goal. Now, a lot of the scientists have spent their careers following the UN and other directives, agreements, and worked for 20, 30, 40 years on reducing emissions as the goal. So they're not always receptive to this whole new paradigm of saying, that's not good enough. You know, when you're flying a plane, one of your objectives is not to crash. But you also need a goal to get to New York by 3 o'clock with everyone safely and get everybody out. So we have, our current goal is simply not to crash, to avoid the worst of climate chaos. We're suggesting we need to make the goal actually restoring the climate that we know we can survive on. So that's kind of, it's really a paradigm shift. Once we make that the goal, there will be a whole lot more science, a whole lot more activity, a whole lot. For instance, one of these big four, which is restoring fertility and photosynthesis in the ocean, there's currently a consortium of about 40 universities around the world who study oceanography and marine biology, and they are they're planning to look into that from all kinds of aspects. However, the only way you really know that it will work is to do it, and it has been done, and it did work. So, yeah, people are in varying stages of acceptance and enthusiasm about climate restoration.
Well, it certainly is an intriguing notion, and one that comes from a place of ultimate optimism. And this is a book that is carefully and meticulously crafted, and in reading it, one can explore all of these intriguing possibilities further. The book, again, is titled Climate Restoration, The Only Future That Will Sustain the Human Race. It is published by Rivertowns Books. The co-author, Peter Fikowski, and my morning show guest, Carol Douglas. Carol Douglas, thank you for being with me on the morning show today and for having this intriguing conversation. A very best wishes to you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And we will continue to celebrate Earth Day in part two of today's program. We're going to the Morning Show archives for a conversation recorded and initially broadcast back in early 2023 with the founder and executive director of the Environmental Integrity Project talking about the work of the EPA. Of course, there have been many dramatic changes in Washington since 2023, so some of what is talked about in terms of specifics no longer applies. But there is a lot of fascinating information about the EPA and its importance and how it operates that I think remains very, very relevant. So here is that interview. We're going to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about the work of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and more specifically focusing on the ways in which the EPA seems to be falling behind more and more, perhaps dangerously so. Certainly that is the contention of my morning show guest, Eric Schaefer, executive director of the Environmental Integrity Project and a former director of civil enforcement at the EPA. And in a recent news release, the Environmental Integrity Project has sought to highlight what it sees as clear and unmistakable signs of decline in the effectiveness of the EPA, and in specifically to the extent to which the EPA is carrying out its duties of environmental regulation. And there are a number of different reasons for this which are explored and which we are going to be talking about for the next few minutes. Eric Schaefer, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
Before we proceed any further, I think it would be helpful if our listeners could learn a little more about the Environmental Integrity Project, when it was created, by whom, and for what specific purpose.
I started the organization in 2002 after I left the U.S. EPA. We focus on the enforcement of federal laws. We do some work to try to improve regulations, and we do an awful lot of data analysis to examine how well the enforcement program is doing, but we also look at emissions and wastewater discharges from various industries to try to find hot spots and get something done about them.
As somebody who has been part of the EPA, I think you're in a position to shed some light for the rest of us on exactly how the regulatory process at the EPA works, or at least how it is intended to work. And I think it's important for us to outline that before we then delve into the matter of how the EPA is, to some extent at least, failing in its mission or purpose, or at least falling behind. First of all, give us a sense of how EPA is put together, and in particular how this aspect of its work is supposed to be carried out.
I'm glad to. Let me see if I can set that up. You start with the law, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act. We've got federal statutes that are supposed to provide for safe management of hazardous waste, protect drinking water, and so on. Those are the federal laws. They're a couple inches thick, and a lot of them are very specific about what the various polluting sources and the agencies that regulate them are supposed to do. The next step is EPA takes those laws and issues various regulations to try to put them into effect. So, for example, they will define wastewater discharge limits for refineries or sewage treatment plants, or they will set limits on the emissions of hazardous air pollution from various industries. Once that's done, states then can assume the responsibility for implementing those rules, and they do that by carrying out inspections, issuing permits, and sometimes doing enforcement actions. But even at that stage, the U.S. EPA is responsible for overseeing the state programs to make sure they're getting the results that the laws are supposed to get us in terms of cleaner air and water. But also, the agency keeps the authority to enforce. So it'll share the authority to enforce. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of the biggest, most difficult cases, and particularly the enforcement actions against home state polluters that might be a little bit politically protected from too much enforcement by the state agency, in those situations, EPA comes in. They'll often do cases that involve multiple plants in more than one state. Of course, state agencies can't do that. And in some cases, the state agency doesn't have any authority to implement the specific federal requirement at all. And in short, EPA is the only game in town. And that's true for a lot of the wetlands standards, for example. Very few states have authority to run the federal wetlands program. So a little bit of a complicated answer, but EPA shares enforcement authority with states. EPA has to step in and take enforcement actions when states can't or won't. They tend to do that in the especially complicated cases involving big polluters. So for the U.S. EPA to have the capacity to do that is very important.
And when there is wrongdoing that is uncovered by the EPA, where, for instance, a given environmental regulation is being ignored, then what is typically the process, and what are the means by which the EPA can, in a sense, bring its authority to bear, bring down its wrath upon those who are disregarding environmental regulations?
So if the violations are criminal, that is, they're deliberate and knowing. The best example is Volkswagen was caught cheating in terms of avoiding the emission control requirements that its cars were supposed to carry as a matter of federal law. And they knew, and they doctored the controls, so they didn't really work. So we end up with the agency, in that case, bringing a criminal action. You can, in the worst cases, face jail time. And I believe a couple of the executives did in that case. But most of the actions of EPA are civil, and that means the agency hasn't have to show that you've deliberately violated the law, even though I think most companies know when they violated the law. Those civil actions are usually negotiated, and they result in a settlement. And that settlement requires the polluter to pay a penalty if the violations are bad enough, and to always to clean up any of the illegal pollution that they created.
We're speaking with Eric Schaefer, executive director, founder of the Environmental Integrity Project, a former director of civil enforcement at the EPA. So you have just helped to release a report that draws attention to what most people who care about the environment would regard as alarming numbers involving the EPA and its level of enforcement. And this is something which is the result of analysis that you and others, your colleagues, have done, analyzing essentially 20 years of EPA enforcement data. And the indications would seem to be of a rather drastic decline in terms of the level of enforcement. First of all, sketch out for our listeners specifically the numbers that we are talking about to kind of crystallize the situation.
Sure. Here are a few numbers, and I'm only going back to, I'll go back 10 years to make this a little simpler. In the past 10 years, the number of inspections that EPA carries out has dropped by more than 40%. The number of criminal investigations they've conducted by more than half. The number of enforcement actions last year are about 44% below the average. I'm sorry, the number of enforcement actions last year are 44% below what they were in 2012. Our report shows you what the averages were for various administrations, and you can see that this is a trend, not a one-time drop. And when I talk about the number of enforcement actions dropping, I'm talking about the ones that got across the finish line and actually resulted in cleanup and payment of a penalty. So those are down 44% over the last 10 years. If you want one example, the biggest cases are brought by the Justice Department. against the biggest cases are brought by the Justice Department against big violators like auto companies or steel plants or power plants, for example, power companies. EPA closed 72 of those in 2022. In the first Obama term, average in the first Obama term was 182 of those Department of Justice actions. So the Justice Department nailed an average of about 182 polluters a year on behalf of EPA, working with EPA. That dropped down to 72 in 2022. So that's a pretty steep decline.
And of course, I'm sure it's your contention that this is not because there are many fewer cases of wrongdoing that need to have enforcement. I mean, we're talking about other factors, and it's probably important for us to understand what those factors may be. It sounds like chief among them are some really serious budget cuts at the EPA, which have necessitated some very significant layoffs of personnel. Tell us more about that, at what point that began, and how clearly that correlates to the declining numbers that you were just outlining for us.
Those budget cuts really began in 2012. And since that year, EPA has lost almost a third of its enforcement staff. They have more than 1,000 fewer positions than they had in 2012. It's really hurt EPA's ability to inspect, to investigate, to monitor for compliance, and to bring enforcement actions. And that's really not surprising. In fact, for the first time this year, EPA, in its annual report on its enforcement accomplishments, provides the public with a chart that shows the decline in the number of cases they've been able to successfully conclude. And next to it, they show a corresponding decline in the number of staff they have to do enforcement work. And you can see those lines run in parallel. They both show a steady decline, and they run down along the graph in tandem. You can see that they're pretty directly related.
Hmm. Your report also makes mention of Congress failing to confirm President Biden's nominee for administrator of the EPA's Civil Enforcement Office, David Ullman. Can you tell us more about that, and if that holdup is still in place, even with control of the Senate having shifted to the Democrats with this latest election?
I expect after the last election that within the next several months we'll finally see David Ullman get approved. Let me just start by saying he was nominated by President Biden in June of 2021. The Biden administration's still in his third year, and he hasn't been confirmed by the Senate yet. Neither has the head of the Office of Air and Radiation, neither has the head of the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. And as far as I know, they have yet to confirm the person who will be managing the budget and basically the operational side of EPA. So at least four of these nominees haven't been confirmed. In David Ullman's case, there's no objection to his credentials. He's got letters of support from everybody, former Republican political appointees, industry attorneys, the environmental groups, states. He's a very non-controversial, straight shooter. Enforcement shouldn't be partisan, and you know, it's not, except for a while under the Trump administration. He brings those credentials to the table, and he just hasn't been able to get him through. His nomination has been blocked. I think this year it'll start to move, but but wow, you know, we're in the third year of the presidency, and maybe about a third of the way through it, we'll finally get a political chief for the enforcement program. It's just, I've never seen it this bad.
Your report also makes mention of the fact that the declines are not just in the number of criminal investigations that have come forward and cases brought to the Justice Department and that and so on, but that also there has been a decline in a sense, certain positives, if we want to call them that. For instance, something called supplemental environmental projects, which if I understand correctly, would be projects that are intended to kind of move the needle in positive directions, and we're seeing fewer of those. Can you help us understand what that is about and what that really means?
Sure. These environmental projects are negotiated in settlements with polluters who are required, no matter what, to return to compliance, and that can involve, you know, tens of millions of dollars in cleanup costs, sometimes even more if you're talking about multiple plants. The environmental projects are something extra that can be very helpful to a community. In the case of, let's say, violations of the Clean Water Act, a polluter agrees to pay for preservation of certain wetlands that can help to reduce the amount of runoff that goes into a river. And, of course, create a real nature preserve for the local community. Those kinds of things help a community that's already kind of had to live through and experience the illegal pollution for a long time. The Trump administration came in determined to kill that, and they were, in part, I think, the hard right was furious about the Volkswagen settlement, which included a couple of $1 billion in projects to do things like install electric vehicle charging stations, help convert diesel-burning buses, school buses, to natural gas or other clean fuels. A lot of good things, in my opinion, but they were mad about it, and they immediately moved to try to cut off the agency's authority to negotiate those projects with polluters. So last year, there were basically none. $1 million, I think, was the total value of the environmental projects that nationwide the Justice Department and EPA were able to get for communities. They plan to change that this year. They finally revised the policy to eliminate the, you know, Trump restrictions, and I expect we'll see more environmental projects this year. Hmm.
A last question. When we read this project on your agency's web, your group's website, again, the Environmental Integrity Project, the headline is EPA enforcement plummets to new low under Biden in key areas. One might read that headline and consider it something of a direct indictment on President Biden himself. I mean, that he holds a significant amount of responsibility for this. As we read the report, it seems that the responsibility is not really lodged with President Biden specifically, or not to too much of an extent, as it is maybe other factors, including, of course, the U.S. Congress. Was that headline crafted consciously to draw attention to anything that President Biden has either done or failed to do to contribute to what you see as a pretty serious situation?
It was. President Biden nominated a good guy to head up the enforcement program, and he did ask for more money than Congress appropriated in the first couple of years. So a lot of the responsibility falls on Congress. The bulk of the responsibility falls on Congress. But you want a White House and a new administration to fight for its priorities, to fight for its nominees, to really press for more enforcement funding, to put some muscle into it. And we didn't see enough of that. Frankly, the other problem is we had a Democratic Congress starting in 2000, after the 2018 elections, and we didn't see much attention from the Hill either to this, you know, slow deterioration of enforcement. I do want to say there's some good news after all this gloomy stuff, which is this year Congress increased the appropriations for EPA enforcement for the first time in a very long time, more than 10 years. Several senators, Senator Durbin, Senator Markey, Senator Warren from Massachusetts, put some time and effort into pushing enforcement resources up for a change. So it doesn't go far enough, and you can't go all the way back in a single year, so I don't even mean that as a criticism. It doesn't repair the damage. Let me try this. It doesn't repair all of the damage that's been done to enforcement over the last decade, but it is a good start.
Hmm. But it needs to continue. It needs to go further. That is certainly your contention.
It really does. Hmm. It needs to go further. And, you know, nobody likes to pay taxes, but for perspective, I checked on the cost overrun for a single aircraft carrier, the Gerald Ford aircraft carrier. Just the cost overrun in that case, not the total amount they spent on the carrier, but just the amount by which they exceeded the budget, would pay for EPA's enforcement program, entire enforcement program, for more than 4 years. So we're not talking about a lot of money. When you have enforcement, polluters pay penalties, that goes to Treasury, so there's really no net cost to taxpayers to fund a strong enforcement program.
People can read more about what we have been discussing on the website of the Environmental Integrity Project and its founder and executive director, Eric Schaefer. Eric Schaefer, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And here is a quick update on one of the specific concerns mentioned by Eric Schaefer in the interview that you just heard. At one point, he expressed grave concern and frustration over the protracted delay in the confirmation of David Ullman to be assistant administrator of the EPA. A few months after this interview aired, David Ullman was confirmed by the U.S. Senate. He served the EPA until late 2024. Last month, President Trump announced a 65% reduction in the EPA's personnel, which numbers roughly 17,000. Very quickly, that was amended to say that the agency's overall budget would be reduced 65%. It remains to be seen just what the EPA will look like or how its work will change under President Trump in his second term. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Ross Bennis talks about his newest book, which is called 1999, The Year Low Culture Conquered America and Kickstarted Our Bizarre Times. He takes a look at a number of examples of so-called low culture that dramatically rose in prominence that year, including the Jerry Springer Show, the World Wrestling Federation under Vince McMahon, the video game Grand Theft Auto, and much more. That's coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show. On Thursday, we will observe Holocaust Remembrance Day. On Friday, we will preview two orchestra concerts coming up this weekend, one by the UW Parkside Orchestra, the other by the Racine Symphony. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find The Morning Show archive on our website, WGTD.org. And don't forget about the podcast version of the program. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Partly sunny skies. We did have a brief shower here at our WGTD studios within the last few minutes. We're headed for a high of 65 degrees, cooler near the lake. Partly cloudy overnight. Both tonight and tomorrow, a 40% chance of rain. Overnight, low of 48. Tomorrow's high, 68 degrees. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and